There's a famous letter of Rabbi Zettler. Rabbi Zettler was a famous Baal Mussar, a famous leader of the Mussar movement in the mid-20th century. He died in 1954, if I recall correctly. And he started off in Lithuania, of course. Before the war, he went to England, where he was one of the founders of the Gates of Yeshiva, one of the major yeshiva in England. And after the war, he went to Panovich, which is one of the great yeshivas in Israel, in Bnei Brak. And for the rest of his life, for his first, he's about this time between Bnei Brak and England, but eventually he settled firmly in England in Panovich. And he was asked a question by the his students in Gates. He was asked, they wanted to set up a institution which would grant teaching certificates, or BAs in education, to people who worked in the yeshiva, who weren't going to go on to be the next, you know, the great scholars of the next generation. So they would be able to go out and teach, primarily the Mudei Kodesh, primarily religious studies, but also secular studies, in schools throughout England. And it sounded like a good idea. And they wrote the letter to the Chazon Ish. They wrote the letter to Rabbi Gessler, who brought the letter to the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish was one of the greatest halachic minds of the 20th century. Probably, that's maybe a little bit overstatement, but probably the last great Jewish leader of the, which we had. He died in also around 1954. And asked the Chazon Ish what to do about this. So the Chazon Ish gave him a fascinating answer. And in order to, the Chazon Ish said, no, we're not allowed to found this institution. And Rabbi Zettler goes on to explain why the Chazon Ish forbade this institution from being founded. And he says in Europe, there were two primary approaches towards the education of the next generation. And, of course, there were many variations on the theme, and depends what country you're in. Oh, thank you. But, in general, there were two primary approaches which existed. They said there was the opinion approach of the yeshivas and the approach of Frankfurt, Germany. What was the difference between the two? He said in Frankfurt, the approach was that to produce Balabatim, householders, people who were the worker bees, so to speak, who went out to work and earned a living, raised a family, and they were all, more or less, upstanding, shomrei Torah mitzvot, they were in Shemayim, they lived in awe of heaven, and they meticulously observed the mitzvot. But they weren't scholars. In fact, in the days of Rav Shamsherfeld Hirsch, who was one of the great leaders of German Jewry, and one of the major rabbis in Frankfurt am Main, to be in the middle of the 19th century, till the 1880s, there was no yeshiva in Frankfurt. There was no yeshiva. There was only the elementary school and the high school. And when his son-in-law, Rabbi Shlomo Breuder, who took over from him, wanted to found a yeshiva in Frankfurt, there was great opposition to the founding of the yeshiva, because it was not something which had been done in Frankfurt to that point. So, in that educational system, in fact, the boys and girls used to learn exactly the same thing. I don't think they were mixed classes, if I recall correctly, but the curriculum was identical. And the reason why it was identical, because there wasn't the great stress on Gemara, which there is today in Yeshiva, perhaps they didn't learn any Gemara, and therefore the curriculum was more or less identical between the boys and the girls, both in the religious studies and in the secular studies. In yeshivas, things are very different. In yeshivas, primarily in Eastern Europe, the model being Balazan, Slabodka, Mir, the great yeshivas in Eastern Europe, there was no set curriculum, as it is to this very day. Something that going to yeshiva learns a specific mesechta for, let's say, one part of the day, but other than that, a person is free to do as he pleases. Also, you don't get a smorgasbord of topics, but rather there's primarily Gemara, Gemara, and more Gemara. Also, there is no there's no framework. For the student who's not going to be the brilliant Gemara scholar of the next generation, there are no accommodations made for him. And this is intentional. It's an intentional way of setting up the system, according to the Chazon Ish of that. But because the Gemara says that 1,000 people enter into the study of Chumash, of the Bible, in the early ages, at a young age, and one of that 1,000 comes out and becomes the posek, the great halachic leader of the next generation. The implication of that Gemara is that, through the Chazon Ish of that, so understood it, at 999 fall by the wayside. The average is 1 out of 1,000, you lose the other 999. And the way they put it, Rav Dessler Chazon Ish, is that Zeh HaMechir, this is the price. In other words, when you're trying to educate the next, trying to bring about the great giant of the next generation, sometimes the price is 999 people who fall through the cracks. When they fell through the cracks, since there was no safety net, so some of them fell very far. We know that some of the great leaders of the Zionist movement, the Hebrew cultural movement, the Yiddish cultural movement, were yeshiva alumni. The famous, most famous one is Bialik, who was a student at Belozhin, and then wrote a devastatingly critical poem about his life in Belozhin called Hamasmid, which is one of the great critiques of the yeshiva system. And Hamasmid literally means the diligent learner. And he was one of the primary examples of somebody who fell through the cracks. Since that is the case, but the idea is, okay, if they fall through the cracks, there's not much we can do, because we're out to produce not a generation of, so to speak, mediocre but upstanding Jews, but rather we're out to produce the great genius of the next generation. Now, said the Chazon Ish, if you allow a seminary in, or college, whatever you want to call it, in the gateway of the type that you want to set up, then what's going to happen is that certain people who may otherwise have become Gedolei Torah, the great giants of the next generation, are going to be attracted by this kosher option. Well, how is it an option? Not just because you're able to make a living that way, but also because it is considered to be an officially sanctioned, dignified, and respectable pursuit. And we don't want, again, says the Chazon Ish of Dessler, that people should have an alternative to achieve respect, acceptability, and dignity within the Jewish community other than being great Torah scholars. We want the alternative to be that if they fall through the cracks, they're going to become carpenters, farmers, blacksmiths, petty tradesmen, and shopkeepers. Because that way they know if they want to vie for the position of leader, they have no choice, and they will, you know, this is the shalolish law, the reason, the motivation to learn Torah, not necessarily for the proper reason, but an effective reason. They'll be driven by the prestige which they can only acquire by being great Torah scholars. We don't want to give them an alternative by which they can achieve prestige in any other manner. So therefore, they both said, this would be forbidden, and it never happened, to start such a seminary for men in Gateshead as a result. Now, does everybody understand so far what we've said?
So this is,
everybody's been so quiet.
This is both Dessler and
the combination. Right.
So it's kind of interesting. What about people that just, they can't achieve that level? Or the ones that aren't cut out for the D, that maybe they're just cut out to be the shopkeeper or the blacksmith, right?
Right. So they'll drop out of the system and they'll become shopkeepers.
I have a problem with just the way that they, they'll drop out of the system. Like there's only the system, and like there's no room for these people who can't accomplish what the system says that they should be able to accomplish. And they're like less of, they're less than the ones who are sitting in yeshiva and become accomplished Torah scholars. I just don't that's absurd and ridiculous.
Yeah. Seemingly, that's just the point. Is otherwise, whereas in a previous situation, it would be that those who were of a certain caliber would be in yeshivas and be in situations of those caliber, and the people who were simply balabadasha people would just simply be balabadasha people. To establish it and institutionalize it this way ensures that there will be a social hierarchy that is guaranteed out of it, because everyone goes through that system. Everyone will then see they're not achieving that goal as a failure, and then they will see themselves as failures in that way, because that is success. That is esteem. Becoming the Bala Torah in the generation is the goal, and anyone who has not achieved that is a failure. That establishes what will be what is that one measures by, and that's why having a teacher's system or whatever seminary would be a threat to that. And that instead of having one child in one family line and there not being any cousins, that means at some point it would be that someone would have more than one child and there would then be cousins. There would be ancillary systems that would potentially be considered of a similar value. But what was the thing of them seeing that as a threat? Are they then just entailing that everyone has this drive to do other than learn Torah, period?
Not everyone, but in other words, the one person who might have become, let's say, the Moshe Feinstein to the next generation, instead, at age 20, he'll see, you know what, instead of continuing in the only way I know to achieve prestige and climb to the top, I have an alternative. I can achieve respectability, honor, and dignity by becoming a high school teacher or an elementary school teacher. So then, in that case, he's going to take, especially because, you know, living a lifetime devoted to Torah study entails a lot of hardship and difficulty, and you might fail along the way, of course, because 999 people do fail, and therefore, I'll take the easy way out. So what Rabbi Destin and the Chazir is saying is we want to limit, that's not the right word, we want to eliminate your escape hatch of taking the easy way out to a dignified career other than learning Torah.
That's more palatable than the way it's
What did I say before?
No, the way you said it, it's just maybe the way I understood it differently. I thought they were saying that these people are worthy, the ones that achieve Torah, great heights in Torah, and the ones that don't. Like, you become just like everyone else, and we're not really concerned with, you know, what your lot is in life.
Like, that's
just
my...
It's
the same thing. Yeah.
Right, but the way I just understood it now is
we're not concerned. You'll go to the great Torah scholar, will be your leader, and you will go and you'll submit himself yourself to his authority.
The difference of what I understood was that the latter thing that you said was that it would prevent someone who is his natural inclination is to underachieving, right? That they'll actually be driven to achieve, as opposed to someone who maybe they're not an underachiever. Maybe it's just, you know, that's what they're cut out for in life. You know, they're cut out to be an electrician, a plumber, I don't know, whatever they're doing, carpenter. You know, but it's not that they're an underachiever. You know, it's just that they can't, they're just not able to achieve great heights in Torah. I mean, in life.
That's interesting. You see, what you're saying is not quite, no, it's not. That's not what they were saying. They were not saying that some people are cut out to be electricians, plumbers, and therefore they should pursue the electrician plumber route.
Right.
What they're saying is that everybody should try to become a God of the Torah. All 1,000 of them. Then when they wash out, you know, what does that talk about?
That being the expectation.
What?
That being the expectation.
When they reach their limit.
Yeah, when they have their crisis, then they'll go and they'll become electricians, plumbers,
right.
et cetera, right?
Right.
That's the way the system is being structured. By the way, the first time I heard the Chazon Ish, and I was in yeshiva, I think I was 17 years old, first time I heard it, I also had the same reaction you had. And over the years, I came to realize it's not so simple. It's not so clear. In other words, the Chazon Ish actually wants to make this clear to you. As I said, the Chazon Ish was, I think, the last great leader that Judaism had. The last of the leaders since then, but he was above and beyond everybody else because he actually had, particularly in Israel, and Great Britain might not have worked so well, but in England, in Israel, he had a vision of what he intended Orthodox Jewish society to look like. He wanted Orthodox Jewish society to look like a society where there were a few giants in Torah who were leading the population, and the overwhelming majority of the population were involved in these trades or farming and things of that like. there would be the question of where there would be doctors and lawyers and accountants, he didn't want those to come from the Orthodox community. Those should come from somewhere else. Okay? Which is interesting approach. It probably would have worked.
Yeah, it's a lot more complicated than I mean, I couldn't sum it up in a sentence. Now I'm sitting here and you're speaking and I'm thinking about it. There's a lot that can be said. So I should just leave it because I can't go into great detail about it. But I understand it is very complicated. You know, because I'm thinking about the guy who is the shopkeeper who doesn't become a Torah scholar. And it's something I think we learned last night about the person who does one mitzvah and does it, you know, with kavana and he does it correctly. And I mean, what's the goal of us as someone who's a Torah scholar anyway? It's what
No, not quite.
No, I'm just saying, what is the Vegas concept, not a Lithuanian concept.
The goal of Torah. Which means to keep Torah and to well learn Torah, whatever you can, and keep the mitzvahs as meticulously as you can, right? And you know, and that would be the ideal, even for most people, perhaps. But the educational system is structured in a way which has an inherent and large measure of risk, and that's the difference. In other words, the end product of the Chazanish's dropout and the Frankfurt primary graduate is not that different. Although in Frankfurt, they're more likely to be professionals. They would be to be in the blue-collar system of the Chazanish. The thing is that in the Frankfurt system, there's very little risk. Because since you're giving everybody a broad curriculum with lots of good foundations, so there's very little likelihood of dropouts. Whereas in the yeshiva system, since you're giving everybody a very narrow spectrum, and you're focusing almost exclusively on Gemara and Halacha, so then there's a very high degree of risk. Because the guy who's not given the foundations, once contented with some temptation, once confronted with some temptation, might very well, you know, go completely off the beaten path. Yeah.
So I guess I just want to understand then, if you said that the goal of Torah learning is to keep the mitzvah, right? Is that what we just said from the Chazanish's point of view? Right, what was it? So Torah scholar, the goal of Torah study is to what?
Just to make a great Torah scholar.
Right, but ultimately to what? To keep the mitzvah, to...
No, to teach everybody else and to maintain them Torah from generation to generation.
Okay, and what's the goal of teaching everyone else so they can what?
So they can live their rudimentary life according to Torah without it.
What's the goal? I mean, where's Hashem in the picture is what I'm saying. Where's the relationship with God in that whole structure? Like the people that are being taught is so they can live their lives as upright people, right? With a close... With, I mean, you say this debate is... there's a concept, but there's obviously a goal to have a relationship with God, right? To have an understanding. No?
No. That's a fitted concept.
I guess I'm just trying to understand because this is new stuff in your setup.
What do you think, if you step out of the box for a minute, right? Let's say you were not a chassid, right? You were clean-shaven Lithuanian misnagid, right? So how would you define, or a trim beard? So how would you define what a person is supposed to do in this world? It doesn't have to do with connecting to God. It has to do with living an upright, honest, you know, straight and proper Torah life. When you get up to heaven, they ask you four questions. I don't think I only remember three. But four, so I think they ask four. They ask you... I don't remember three. Maybe only asked three. Nasata Vemuna, were you honest in your business dealing? Kabbalah Yisim Torah, did you set specific times for Torah study? And Tipis of Yeshua, did you look forward for the redemption?
But that also, did you teach your children? I know something with children.
Oh, that's right. That's the fourth one. Thank you. Nasata Vemuna, did you try and get married and have kids? So that's the fourth question. Where does it say anything about that? Did you try to achieve faith within Hashem?
But I think, you know, just by the concept of learning Torah means like you're serving Hashem. There's service of Hashem in that structure somewhere, right?
All these four questions. These are the four things that a person does. As Gemara Shabbat says, these are the four ways, primary ways in which you serve Hashem in this world. Being honest, learning, looking forward to the redemption, and trying to be fruitful and multiply. The Hasidim came along, I'm not saying it's wrong, you know, it works for lots of people, but the Hasidim came and said, yeah, but a primary value which transcends all those specific questions is the value of feeling connected to Hashem. Wesley Yetter, to a German Jew in the 19th century, and he said, you know, I wouldn't say Rabbi Yid because that would kind of be pumped. Herr Yid, he would say, you know, do you feel connected to Hashem? So he looked at you as you came off down from the moon, right? Not really what he's supposed to feel. He's supposed
what
to
you're
do.
Told.
Yeah, what he's supposed to do. That's it.
That just seems like such an intellectual, segregated approach to God.
Why is it intellectual?
I don't know, because it just seems like it's, I don't know, it's like it's compartmentalized. Like, here's my, you know, I'm doing this because I don't know why, just because it's what I'm supposed to be doing. But, like, there's no,
it's a remarkable thing about it. Most people don't really need to know why they're doing what they're doing. Have you not noticed that?
It's not even a knowing of what I mean. We all thought, it's all about questioning, isn't it? So everyone wants to know why. It is what learning's about. We question, right? That's how we learn.
Most people don't want to know.
I'm not arguing, I'm just trying to learn. That's why I'm just...
No, I'm saying it. I'm saying most people don't want to know. That's the famous Harvard study, right? Famous Harvard study where they had people, so, you know, they gave people, they connected people to, what are they called? I think it was a transmitted electric shock. Diodes? What are they called?
Electric shock machines.
Electric shock machines, right. And they put them behind, inside a chamber. And they took the subject in the study, and the subject in the study was told to turn up the voltage, you know, that of a voltage meter, to turn up the voltage, and to whatever level they're told to. And
oh, every time they got a wrong answer. Every time the person got a wrong answer?
No, I didn't do that. And it was clearly marked on the meter what dosage was dangerous and what dosage was lethal, or, you know, close to fatal, whatever. So therefore, they asked people to turn up the dial. Of course, the dials, they were dummy dials, right? Nothing happened to the person who was hooked up to the electric shock machine. But they had no way of knowing that, right? So they found an astronomical amount of people, I think more than 60%, would turn up the dial. They might be nervous about it, but they would turn up the dial all the way up to lethal, right? So, you know, most people don't question authority. If a guy, that's why...
And that's the intent of the system is establishing authority.
That's why, I realized that that's the reason why, doctors wear white coats. Right? What are you wearing these white coats for? It's so silly. It doesn't make any difference to your internist, right? You go to your doctor, who's not going to do anything to do with your blood, and he wears this white coat. Right? Why does he wear the white coat? Because it gives him authority. And therefore, he can tell you to get undressed. You know, do whatever else he wants to do to you. What?
No, me. That's why I wear a white coat.
But in any event, so that is the average, that's most people do better and have less anxiety functioning under a system in which there is authority which tells them what to do. And it's not so important for them to know why they're doing what they're doing.
So it's almost like ruling out the cure, right?
No, their free will. They choose to submit to this system. That's their free will.
But I mean, there's submission also among Hasidim, right? You submit to a Rav.
But there's very little free will there too.
I mean, you can still choose not to, right?
Right, everyone chooses. That's basically what you have to choose, whether you want to commit to the system or not. That's it. Once you commit to the system, then very little of that, your subsequent behavior is your free will.
Yeah, it's just a hard concept. This
kind of thing, as far as you know,
like trying to get my
head around exactly. No, with this, understand. Yeah, it's hard to understand.
Okay, yes.
Sorry. This guy is crazy. I'm serious.
Which guy?
The rabbi, who everybody says is one of the greatest rabbis of like recent
time.
He's insane.
I wouldn't put it that way. It's not. I wouldn't want to get zapped with a lightning bolt if I were you, so I would refrain from using such a comment.
Wait. Okay.
Take, you don't understand his approach. Do me a favor. Don't call him insane, please. He wasn't insane.
Well, I don't think he's supposed to talk to this for
right, he wasn't insane. He was very, very, very smart.
He was not...
You disagree, you
I don't disagree with him strongly.
You beg to differ with him.
Yeah,
that's better.
Okay.
He has a different opinion, which is completely wrong.
That's right. Okay.
All right.
Everybody stay away from him because when lightning bolt comes, he's going to hit. Yeah.
All right. How can you look forward to the redemption if you're saying how can you look forward to the redemption if you don't have a relationship, if you're not connected, if you have no feeling in this whatsoever? How can you possibly look forward to the
redemption? Hey, even a simple Jew who's not a scholar, who's a shopkeeper or, you know, a porter or whatever he is, he has a sense that the Jewish people have a mission. However sophisticated or unsophisticated his understanding is, he has a sense that people are here for a reason. He has a sense that Am Yisrael suffers and goes. So he has a sense that things should be better for us.
Yeah, but
go back
he should have learned Torah because he screwed up his assistants, you know. It's like, you know, bug off, we don't want you here anymore in the yeshiva.
Nobody said that.
You said your elementary existence. You're a little, you know, become a plumber, we don't want you in the yeshiva anymore.
Nobody kicked him out of the yeshiva, he decided to become a plumber.
No, you said because if he doesn't become a great scholar, then he has... So
eventually he's going to have to do something, right? Won't be able to make a living as a great scholar if he isn't a great scholar, right?
Yeah,
so then, he'll decide to become a plumber.
The point of Yeshua is not to produce great scholars, though. It's to, and that's what this guy's saying, the point of Yeshua is to produce great Torah leaders and everybody else just leads not as an elevated an existence as a great Torah scholar and has to work in some elementary professions.
I understand, but the first part of your sentence, you said Yeshivas are not meant to produce great Torah scholars?
I don't think they are.
Of course they are.
They can.
No, the whole curriculum is based on producing great Torah scholars.
They can, but...
Let me add to that. To this very day, if you go to a yeshiva high school, most yeshiva high schools, from right wing to left wing, all types, they are still primarily based on the European model, on the Eastern European model, Lithuanian model, because primarily, at least for boys, you know, the study... still is Gemara, Gemara, and more Gemara. So this is mattering, you know, like a token amount of Shulchan Aruch, Halacha, a token amount of Tanach Chumash, sometimes a token amount of Katz Moser, but the primary focus is to expand the contours of the student's mind with more and more Gemara.
Okay, that's fine. But
what do you mean, it's fine? So now you're bringing the calculation.
No, it's fine that everybody should learn Gemara to enrich their lives, but the point is...
How Gemara enrich your life? Wouldn't it be much more enriching for you to learn Jewish thoughts, Tanakh, facts from Halacha?
I think that everything is Torah enriching.
Right?
I think that everything that you learn that's Torah directed enriches your life.
Well, that's a very nice political answer, but the question is...
No, I really think that.
Just kidding. But there's the assumption in Frankfurt was that the curriculum should be geared to give a person a solid foundation in whatever profession he chose, usually be a banker, an accountant, or something like that, in order that he should be able to live a life which his emunah would not be challenged, his basic concepts would be always present, he'd always have the right idealism and drive. That usually doesn't happen just from learning Gemara. By some people it might, but most people don't get it just learning Gemara.
Really?
Yes.
You're saying every yeshiva is meant to make Torah scholars. What about conservative yeshiva?
No, yeshivas don't learn.
What about this yeshiva?
What?
What about this yeshiva?
It's a natural difference. That's why you have this class.
Right, that's what I thought.
Well, but we also have more, right?
That's why we don't hold this principle that this guy held, obviously, this yeshiva.
Well, this is you mean kind of yeshiva, obviously, right?
Yeah, but there are other yeshivas in the world like this one.
There are several unique yeshivas. What happens is that if you take people at let's say, a relatively advanced age, right, and they have done significant thought outside the system, outside the box, when you want to bring them inside the box, so to speak, so you have to be able to confront many more sophisticated and profound issues, which you would have to do if somebody was raised in a milieu in which those questions didn't exist.
Okay.
Thanks,
so I still don't understand how that type of yeshiva that we're talking about would be even appropriate for somebody who's FFB.
It's not necessarily appropriate for the individual, it's appropriate for the system.
Self-perpetuating. I don't like that.
Right, you don't like yeshiva. I don't like
stuff that's governed around this, like a system ideology. It seems very...
But almost all education systems, even secular educational systems.
Well, I know. The secular education, there's so many problems with secular education. We could get into that. That's a whole separate discussion.
Sure.
That's just ridiculous. I agree with you.
Anyways,
I strongly disagree.
But the rabbi thus far hasn't said that we should accept it as the way.
Well, I'm not going to say that. I'm presenting both sides of the coin.
A historical.
The historical perspective, yeah. You should know that this is actually a very profound, we can peel this back a layer and take it down to a more abstract or more profound level of understanding the issue here. The issue is, what is the most effective educational system? Most effective educational system is one in which you educate the masses and you give the masses, what they can have. And even if the guy who's a brilliant scholar doesn't get what he should be getting, but at least the masses are getting what they're getting, and society is best benefited that way. Or is the educational system meant to produce the elite, the leaders of the next generation? And the masses might not be getting what they're supposed to get directly, but if the elite of the next generation is ensured, then the continuity of the society and the continuity of the tradition will be ensured. Otherwise, it won't necessarily be ensured. Okay? There's no answer to that, by the way. There's no right or wrong way. Both systems have validity, and the question is which system you choose. Really? There is a right answer? So there should be no Harvard. Everybody should go to Rockland Community College.
There's nothing, no. People can go to Harvard if they want to. Not everybody that goes to Harvard becomes a great scholar. I mean, you can go to Harvard just to learn, just to grow for yourself.
True, but the atmosphere in Harvard is structured, I'm assuming. The atmosphere in Harvard is structured to produce great scholars. People who don't...
Sure, but it's not like, oh, screw everybody else who, doesn't quite make it, or isn't the number one in
the class.
I think
it is.
There's a certain criteria you can get in the door.
I think the highly competitive schools is not Harvard than MIT. The highly competitive schools have really competitive standards, which means that if you're not at the top, you're going to have big problems. You're going to have crises, difficulties, you're going to have to either drop out or switch schools or, take
that's
drugs.
True. The secular school system is based around our principles that are very foreign to us.
Are very what?
Foreign.
What do you mean?
I don't think that they're based around our principles.
That's true, but they're based upon
humanistic ideologies. I don't think that it's fair to make that sort of a comparison that you're making.
Why?
Because it's like two different systems of thought.
How so?
Did I already say this?
No, I don't. That's not.
All right.
It's it's not a question of what you know, what we could talk about the difference between the comparison between American schools, American public schools, and the yeshiva system. We talk about this, the difference between the seminaries in Afghanistan and the yeshiva system. I'm just saying the question is what exactly the philosophy underlying system education is, not what the philosophy they're trying to inculcate is.
Yeah.
You're saying the philosophy which the secular education system tends to seem to inculcate is humanism. Okay.
Right. And I think that relates to the philosophy underlying the system of education as well.
How so?
Because if you're living in a humanistic philosophy where everything, where the prevailing thought that's driving the system is basically evolution, that only the tough survive, only the tough are able, and the really smart intellectual ones are able to pass their genes on to the next generation, then you produce a society that holds those values. And a philosophical system underlying the system of the schools that also drives those values. And I think that system doesn't exist in China.
I don't think that most public school systems are based on the survival of the educated fittest principles. I don't think they're based on that mostly.
I think they are. I think they just don't come out and say it. I don't think they come right out and say it, but it's been my experience that is the case.
So basically the thing is that they all hold it in Chazanish. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I chose Chazanish as precedent and other systems.
Yeah, but I don't think you should
endure it. That's your opinion. But obviously most of the world agrees with you, and most of the world replicates the constitutional system.
Yeah, because it's not a, I don't think it's a power system.
Okay.
Here's what.
Yeah.
You said before the most effective education system is to educate the masses and rulers.
Or the elite, not the
four.
Four. The question is which one?
Okay.
Well, at least amongst the systems we're discussing, those are the views of the systems that we're discussing.
Right.
We're not saying these are the only
systems. The assumption is, the assumption of this difference of opinion is you can't have a system which works for both.
Cannot.
Where is that, it's an assumption. I disagree with the assumption.
Have you created an alternative model?
Not that I can think of off the top of my head, but that doesn't mean that we don't exist.
True, but therefore, unless those created and we demonstrated that there is such a model, you really can't assume that they're right, wrong, and you're right.
Yeah, but you can't assume that's not the case. It's just an assumption. It's not proof.
The assumption, which was the experience in Europe between the difference between Germany and those similar yeshivas in Hungary and other places, and Eastern European Lithuanian yeshivas, was precisely this experience. So that was actually a tried and tested difference between the two systems. I gotta tell you a very funny joke. It's not funny. Any joke I tell by definition is not funny. But the first time I heard it, I found it very funny.
Okay, it comes
out. So there was once a boy, the yeshiva bacher, who was learning in Hungary, learning in the Sab Sefer's yeshiva in Hungary. Sab Sefer was the Kaplan Sefer. It's not a very big Talmud Chacham. So he came to the yeshiva in Hungary, and it turned out that one day he was walking down the street with a girl, not his own sister or cousin or whatever, but he's going down to the group. So he came to the Roshim Chodin and said, listen, they don't do this here. It's Preshburg, Hungary, they don't do this here. I can't have you in the yeshiva. But I heard that there's a yeshiva in Frankfurt that they do tolerate these things. So I'll send you to the yeshiva in Frankfurt. Okay? So he brought Buffer goes to Schlingerberg's yeshiva in Frankfurt, right? The more modern city in Frankfurt. So it turns out when he was living in Frankfurt, one day, they used to not have dormitories, people used to stay in people's houses. So one day the household was missing a silver spoon. It was gone. So finally they found that this boy had stolen the silver spoon. So the friend of the boy called him and said, you should know. I'm not kicking you out of the yeshiva because you stole the silver spoon. That's not why. I'm throwing you out because you are an idiot and obviously will never be able to become a Talmud Chacham. Because had you stole the silver spoon in Preshburg and walked with the girl in Frankfurt, you wouldn't have had any problems. But you instead walked with the girl in Freshburg and stole the silver spoon in Frankfurt, so therefore you're an idiot, and therefore you just have to leave. So obviously different yeshivas have different standards.
Remembering that was a joke.
But the generally speaking, the yeshivas are divided into these two main categories, and this is the Chaznish was talking from experience. This is how he experienced things as he was himself involved in, you know, the yeshiva system in Eastern Europe and observed the system in Germany.
Experience doesn't necessarily prove anything,
but
Darwin
devised
the theory of evolution.
You're getting very emotional about this. Why are you so emotional about this?
Because I think that this is a...
This is good.
What?
It's really? I think that these sorts of attitudes are what destroys humanity. I think that it destroys the very essence of how we should exist.
There's another assumption which you're making which is not necessarily correct. The assumption is that the assumption which makes the Chaznish's opinion to a great extent unpalatable to us is the assumption which is prevalent today, that everybody's supposed to go to yeshiva. And since everybody's supposed to go to yeshiva, so therefore yeshivas are supposed to cater to everybody. That was not the case. In Eastern Europe, only the people who were the brightest people would actually go to yeshiva.
Yeah.
They were people who were going to be the elite. Most kids actually went directly from being children to being apprentices and then into the crafts or shops which they intended to serve in for the rest of their life. Very few people, relatively speaking, attended yeshiva. So Chaznish is saying that the institution of the yeshiva should continue to be the same type of institution it was in Eastern Europe. And if these people don't fit into the yeshiva, they just won't come to the yeshiva. They'll have another framework, whatever it is, but not a yeshiva framework. But to have a yeshiva which officially sanctions study of an alternative discipline or an alternative series of courses which will lead to a bachelor's degree or whatever it is, that is something which is a problem. You see that? That was our assumption nowadays that everybody's going to yeshiva. Because the public schools are so rotten for Jews. So therefore everybody's going to go to yeshiva. But until even the 60s, there wasn't even a given assumption.
Mm-hmm.
You know, good kids would go to public school, too.
Yeah. It seems like he's saying, well, the system it seems like he thought that system that already existed was a wonderful idea, and so his idea was just
to perpetuate
the system.
Right.
But I disagree with his initial presumption that the system was a good idea from the start.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that there needs to be a change to the system.
Okay. So I guess you are more in sync with the transfer system.
What? What's that?
The alternative, the one which Rabbi Dessler was rejecting. The system which gave everybody a little bit of everything in order to make sure that they came out to be upstanding members of the community.
Yeah, but I would be more in favor of that, but I think that there's an alternative to it.
Oh, that's an alternative which we haven't proved to exist. That was my first reaction, by the way, when I heard this class many years ago, that there must be a third alternative. I kind of got to think that was the suggestion of the Rebbe from whom I heard this whole issue, but I don't think it's ever been proven that such a thing exists.
Maybe so, and I can't say whether or not it does or not because I just walked into this class and I can't formulate something in 5 minutes and tell it to you,
but for tomorrow you'll be able to do it first.
Yeah, right? But
tomorrow I want to plan on paper in triplicate. Okay, we'll try it and see if we can
Anyways, we'll see. But I like the other guy's point of view better than the Charles and Nietzsche.
Okay. Right. Okay. So these are two primary points of view, and they go back to Gemara and Kiddushin. Gemara and Kiddushin, which we'll see inside tomorrow. But the last Mishnah and Kiddushin actually, the last Mishnah Kiddushin says, Rabbi Yehuda says, Chayav Adam Lelamedes V'no Umnus. A person has to teach his son a craft. Because if he doesn't teach his son a craft, he's teaching him to be a bandit. Meaning that people who don't have a craft eventually comes his need to get money by illicit means and ill-gotten gains, because they don't have a legitimate way in which to make money. That's what Rabbi Yehuda says. Which I'm sure many people here might be a very reasonable approach. Rabbi Noroi is another town in that Mishnah. Rabbi Noroi says, I reject all crafts which exist in the world, all trades. The only thing I'm teaching my son is Torah. In other words, if we know crafts, he doesn't need to know. What he has to know is Torah. And in essence, to a certain extent, so it's not 100% a good parallel, but to a certain extent, that machlekes Rabbi Noroi is the same machlekes we have here between the Hirschian Frankfurt system and the Volozhin or Eastern European system. In the Frankfurt system, you have to have a trade. Very few people could be rabbis. Today there's a huge surplus of rabbis on the market, right? Very few people can actually be rabbis. So therefore, you have to teach somebody a trade, otherwise it's going to end up being a bandit. Whereas, according to Rabbi Nietzsche,
Oh, you're saying there's a huge amount of rabbis, and then your next point was, well, you got to teach everyone a trade or they're going to be a bandit. I think he should have said, you got to teach someone a trade or else they're going to be a rabbi.
Okay. I would not put it that way. But the idea of Rabbi Noroi is, no, you're supposed to teach people how to be Talmid Chachamim. And let the issue, and this is critical, let the issue of how they make a living take care of itself. That's not my concern. If necessary, they'll find a way. Or maybe later on I'll teach them myself. But it's not my responsibility in the here and now to teach them that trade, to teach them that craft. Okay? So, well, there's a major ramification. Before tomorrow we'll get to the sheets. I thought spent a lot of time photocopies and paper, we didn't get there. So basically, in terms of careers, we have two approaches. Neither of which, by the way, so far, allows you to be a doctor, which is what Ramosha Feinstein is going to speak about in Tshuva tomorrow. Is one allowed to take 10 years out of one's life or more in order to study to be a doctor? Here's an interesting question.
Or a rocket scientist.
Or a rocket scientist, right. Right. Or anything of that sort. Or is that just a complete waste of time because there's very much further on that?
10 full years, you have time
to
study, you can learn time.
You're a medical student?
That's later, 1 hour later.
Yeah, maybe. They're lucky.
Right.
It's very hard to go into a medical career. I mean, they're especially even less when you're a medical resident. It's not so simple.